Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello from Washington. We are back to help you learn and improve your American English skills. Each day we present interesting stories from around the world in a way that makes it easy for you to follow along if English is not your first language. Today we have two stories for you. The first one is about a new way to make tea that is easier on the environment. Then we're off to the UK for a story about the real estate market and dirty Russian money. It's a chance for you to listen and learn with the Voice of America. Here is part one. There is a change in the air at the tea factory in Tika, Kenya. It is free of the dark smoke that rises from the boilers of Kenya's other tea factories. The Makumboki Company has begun to use a less costly and more environmentally friendly fuel. Instead of burning wood, the tea maker is burning briquettes made of plant and animal material waste. Jonathan Evans has the story.
The Kenya Tea Development Authority supervises 66 tea factories in the country. Makumboki is the only one that does not use firewood in tea production. Its factory is deep in central Kenya's hilly and fertile tea-growing Murang'a County. The Makumboki employees there feed the factory's boilers with briquettes of macadamia, cashew, and rice husks, the dry outer covering of the seeds mixed with sawdust. John Jatao is the manager at the factory. He expressed excitement about the change in fuel at the factory. He said Makumboki has not used a single cubic meter of firewood in the last 6 months. In 2010, the International Trade Center started a training project. It aimed to teach Kenyan tea makers new production methods that would help limit the release of climate change gases. As a result, Makumboki company leaders decided to change their fuel source from firewood to briquettes. Since then, the factory has increased its use of alternative fuels and stopped depending on firewood. Taylors of Harrogate is a Makumboki client. The British Tea and Coffee Company helped the Kenyan factory change fuels. It connected Makumboki with the Living Earth Foundation. The non-governmental group donated the machines to make the briquettes. The husks for the briquettes come from other factories within Murang'a and Kiambu counties. The sawdust comes from mills near the tea factory. John Jatao said, it takes the factory 6 months to produce about 2.5 million kilograms of tea. During that time, their boilers would use up to 10,000 cubic meters of wood, or about 30,000 trees worth. He said by trading firewood for sawdust and briquettes, Makumboki alone will have saved 60,000 trees in 1 year. And he said, if all the factories in Kenya did this, a lot of trees would be saved. Mary Njinga is a postdoctoral fellow of bioenergy at the World Agroforestry Center. She welcomes the use of sawdust in the making of fuel briquettes. She said, burning sawdust is efficient. The temperatures inside the boilers of tea factories are so high, she said, they are able to more fully burn the particulate matter and the carbon dioxide so that little is released. Makumboki manager John Jatao said, tea factories that continue to use firewood can't ignore their own part in the adverse effects of climate change. The move away from firewood also makes financial sense. Mr. Jatau said changing to fuel briquettes has reduced Makamboki's energy cost by nearly half. The factory used to spend $542,000 per year on firewood. Now, the introduction of briquettes has cut the energy bill to $295,600. John Jatau said representatives from other factories have visited Makamboki to learn more about the alternative fuel. He said he hopes they will follow his company's lead. I'm Jonathan Evans.
You are listening to the Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Anti-corruption activists say billions of dollars earned from criminal acts are passing through the London property market. They also say a lot of the money for housing and other real estate is coming from Russia. The British government is now promising to fight the money laundering activities. But one investment advisor told VOA the government has known about the problem for years. Bob Doty has our report.
Over the past 5 years, major properties in London have risen in value by 42%. Activists say one reason for the increase is the rise in the use of what they call dirty money to buy homes and buildings. Recently, a British television program reported on an investigation into the use of stolen money to buy property. The program was called From Russia with Cash. In the show, anti-corruption activist Roman Borisovich was seen speaking with several real estate agents in central London. Mr. Borisovich told them he was a Russian government minister who wanted to buy property with stolen money. The activist later told VOA on Skype that the agents did not care where the money came from.
They were all eager to proceed. Even if when I was telling them that the money was meant for procurement of drugs, and I stole the money, and you know, obviously some sick people were deprived of health care, and they could not care less.
Mr. Borisovich says the real estate agents all suggested he buy the properties through overseas companies to hide the identity of the buyer. He says one agent proposed he use the relaxed tax laws of Cyprus and the British dependency of Jersey to create a trust. The agent said this legal agreement then could be used to set up what investigators call a shell company.
And this particular agent was volunteering to put us in front of a Jersey financiers to put the trust together and a Cypriot lawyer to put everything else together.
The British government says foreign companies own $191 billion worth of property in Britain. Prime Minister David Cameron has said that most are legal businesses, but he admitted some are not.
We need to stop corrupt officials or organized criminals using anonymous shell companies to invest their ill-gotten gains in London property without being tracked down.
Justin Urquhart Stewart works at Seven Investment Management. The company helps people invest money. He says the British government has known about the money laundering problems for years.
And this is dirty money, coming from crime, maybe coming from terrorism. So this needs to be dealt with now.
British law says real estate agents must tell officials if they believe the money being used to buy property comes from criminal activities. But many agents say they should not be expected to know the source of money, especially when buyers are using complex methods to hide fraud. I'm Bob Doty.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Environment and Science Report. Tigers are the most powerful cats on the planet. Tigers are also endangered. A new study shows that the animals are far more at risk of extinction than wildlife experts believed. The new census found that only about 100 tigers are left in the Sundarbans forest of Bangladesh. The Sundarbans is the largest mangrove forest in the world. It is also one of the last remaining habitats, or natural homes, for tigers. The Sundarbans spread across a 10,000 square kilometer area in southern Bangladesh and the eastern part of India. A number of rivers flow through the area. The Sundarbans is a UNESCO World Natural Heritage Site. About 60% of the mangrove forest is in Bangladesh. In 2004, a separate population count found 440 tigers in the Bangladeshi part of the Sundarbans forest. The finding was based on the study of tiger paw prints, also called pug marks. The latest census used infrared cameras to arrive at what wildlife experts believe is a more exact number. The cameras took pictures when they observed something with body heat. Now, after using camera trapping methods used in both countries, the entire forest is believed to hold about 182 tigers. Indian wildlife scientist Yadvindradev Jala studied the recent tiger censuses. He noted that more than three-fourths of the world's tiger population lives in India and Bangladesh. He said the new numbers show that the species is threatened. He blamed both illegal hunting and a new coal-fired power plant that, he says, will separate some tiger populations from each other. He said the majority of coal needed for the power plant will be brought by barges plying in the water channel from the Bay of Bengal up the Sundarbans. This continuous traffic of commercial boats will form a barrier to tigers dispersing east to west, effectively dividing the Sundarbans population into two halves. Small populations have a high probability of becoming extinct. Manirul Khan is a tiger activist and a member of Bangladesh's National Coordination Committee for Tiger Conservation. He said government officials who oversee wildlife are unable to protect the falling number of tigers. The tigers mainly eat spotted deer. The deer also are heavily poached for meat and skin, further threatening the tigers. Mohammed Jiadol Kabir is with the Bangladeshi Wildlife and Nature Conservation Division. He said the government has taken the latest tiger census report very seriously. He also said the government plans to declare the entire Sundarbans a protected area, restricting activities that threatened the tigers. Some estimates say there are only around 3,200 tigers left in the wild in the world, down from 100,000 in 1900. I'm Jonathan Evans. ¶¶
From VOA Learning English, this is The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we continue the story of the American Revolution. On July 4, 1776, the Second Continental Congress, meeting in Philadelphia, approved the Declaration of Independence. The new country, the United States of America, was at war with its former colonial ruler, Britain. Yet, not everyone in the former colonies agreed with the decision to declare independence. No one knows for sure how many Americans remained loyal to Great Britain. John Adams, the Massachusetts political leader, thought that about a third of the colonists supported independence, a third supported Britain, and a third supported neither side. Today, many historians think that only about 20% of the colonists supported Britain. Some colonists supported whichever side seemed to be winning. As many as 30,000 Americans fought for the British during the war. Others helped Britain by reporting the movements of American troops. Who supported Britain? These groups included people who were appointed to their jobs by the king. They also included leaders of the Anglican Church and people with business connections to the British. Professor Gordon Wood at Brown University in Rhode Island says many colonists from minority groups remained loyal to the king.
One of the problems of the American Revolution that emerged very quickly was the tyranny of the majority, which the founders, the revolutionary leaders, had not anticipated. But I think we're seeing the problems that emerge when you overthrow an authoritarian leader and you're going to have a relatively democratic society, then protecting the minority becomes a problem.
Other people remained loyal because they did not want change or because they believed that independence would not improve their lives. Some thought the actions of the British government were not bad enough to bring about a rebellion. Others did not believe that the rebels could win a war against a nation as powerful as Britain. American Indians disagreed among themselves about the revolution. Congress knew it had to make peace with the Indians as soon as the war started. If not, American troops might have to fight them and the British at the same time. To prevent trouble, American officials tried to stop settlers from moving into Indian lands. In some places, the Indians joined the Americans, but generally they supported the British. They expected the British to win. They saw the war as a chance to force the Americans to leave their lands. At times, the Indians fought on the side of the British, but left when the British seemed to be losing the battle. The Americans did not forget that the Indians chose to fight for the British. When the war was over, the Americans felt they owed the Indians nothing. African slaves in the colonies were also divided about which side to join during the American Revolution. Thousands of slaves fought for the British. The British offered them freedom if they served in the army or navy. Some American states also offered to free slaves who served
and hundreds of free blacks fought on the American side. Many slaves, however, felt their chances for freedom were better with the British. At least 5,000 blacks served with the colonial American forces. Most had no choice. They were slaves, and their owners took them to war or sent them instead of the owners' sons. Other slaves felt that a nation built on freedom might share some of that freedom with them. In the South, many slave owners kept their slaves at home rather than send them to fight. Later in the war, when every man was needed, many slaves drove wagons and carried supplies. Those who served in the colonial army and navy were not separated from whites. They fought side by side with whites during the American Revolution. But historians say most slaves spent the war as they always had, working on their owners' farms. The American rebels called themselves patriots. Those who supported the British were known as Tories. Patriots often seized the property of Tories to help pay for the war. They also kidnapped the slaves of Tories to use as laborers for the army. Many Tories were forced from towns in which they had lived all their lives. Some were tortured or hanged. In New Jersey, Tories and Patriots fought one another with guns and sometimes burned each other's houses and farms. Some historians say the American Revolution was really the nation's first civil war. The Revolution divided many families. Jane Gordon at the Massachusetts Historical Society tells of a woman named Phoebe. Phoebe was married to a patriot, but her brother was a Tory.
And we think about what it must have been like for Phoebe in the middle between her husband and her brother. So that's a perfect example of a family that was split.
The patriots were also split among themselves in their thinking. The colonies did not really think of themselves as one nation. They saw themselves as independent states, trying to work together toward a common goal. Historian Gordon Wood says, at first, the United States was more like the European Union is today.
When Jefferson said, "My country," he meant Virginia. John Adams said, "My country," he meant Massachusetts.
This meant that Congress could not order the states to do anything they did not want to do. Congress could not demand that the states provide money for the war. It could only ask for their help. George Washington, the top general, could not draft men into the army. He could only wait for the states to send them. Washington showed that he was a good politician by the way he kept Congress and the 13 states supporting him throughout the war. Just as Americans did not all agree about the war, the British people did not agree about it either. Many supported the government's decision to fight. They believed that the war was necessary to rescue loyalists from the Patriots. Others did not think Britain should fight the Americans because the Americans had not invaded or threatened their country. They believed that Britain should leave the colonies alone to do as they wished. King George was not able to do this, however. He supported the war as a way to continue his power in the world and to rescue British honor in the eyes of other national leaders. Whichever side British citizens were on, there was no question that the war was causing severe problems in Britain. British businessmen could no longer trade with the American colonies. Prices increased. Taxes did too. And young men were forced to serve in the Royal Navy. At the start of the war, the British believed that the rebellion was led by a few extremists in New England. They thought the other colonies would surrender if that area could be surrounded and controlled. So they planned to separate New England from the other colonies by taking control of the Hudson River Valley. The British changed their plans after they were defeated in the Battle of Saratoga in New York State. Historian Gordon Wood says the British loss changed the nature of the war.
The French feel at this point that the Americans might make it, and therefore they throw in their support. Once the French come on board, then the British are really panicked. At that point, they offer the Americans everything the Americans had wanted, save independence. But it was too late.
The British experienced many problems fighting the war. Their troops were far from home across a wide ocean. It was difficult to bring in more troops and supplies. Gordon Wood says the distance across the Atlantic was one reason the British lost the war.
Even though they were the most powerful nation in the world, had a superb army, and of course completely controlled the seas, and they were dealing with the ragtag army of George Washington and a bunch of militia, and they couldn't do it.
General Washington's army had its own problems too. Congress never had enough money. States often did not do what they were supposed to do. And citizens were not always willing to fight. Soldiers were poorly trained and would promise to serve for only a year or so. The political and economic developments of the American Revolution concerned not just the Americans and the British. European nations were watching the events in America very closely. Those events and the reactions in Europe will be our story next week. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and pictures at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English.